All right.
We are back on record on initiative 2017-2018, number 20. It's about 2:05, and, or 3:05, we understand both proponents are now here. So Mr. O'Connor, if you could just state your name and have your other proponent introduce herself, and then we'll let you kind of catch your breath, and we'll give Mr. Donna a chance to talk.
Okay, I'm Andrew G. O'Connor, proponent on 2017-2018, number 20.
Mary Henry.
And Mr. Dunn has filed a motion for rehearing. And Mr. Dunn, do you want to walk us through your motion or add anything to what you've submitted?
I do. For the record, Jason Dunn on behalf of objector Chad Northman. Some of these arguments are arguments that we made at the hearing last time, and I'll try not to be too repetitive. Essentially, and this is probably as long as a motion for a hearing as I've ever done, because I think there are a variety of important issues for the board to address. And our motion is broken into a couple sections. One is what I would call the sort of jurisdictional drafting issues. The second one is the title issues. Third is the abstract. I think I missed one. But I'll address those as we go. Oh, single subject, thank you. All important single subject. So let me talk about some of the drafting issues. And as we explained in our motion for hearing, those are broken into a couple of areas. And I think the most important one, perhaps, is the measure's description of what's at its heart. The measure at its heart is a severance tax increase. And the original version of the measure that was submitted for review and comment provided a substantial increase to the severance tax, but only by its own terms till January 1, 2018. And essentially what else the measure did was eliminate the severance tax after January 1, 2018. The measure then provides that change in section 2 of the proposal. Subsection B, subparagraph B of the measure. And the original version of the measure does not show that change to the tax schedule. And so I think the important question for the board is, what are you going to expect of proponents of a ballot measure? And what are you going to provide for the voters when they review these original versions? The measure here did not provide that there was any change to that tax schedule. Second, when the measure was submitted, the final version, it included the same schedule into subparagraph C of the measure. And that was obviously in response to review and comment, which I'll get to in a minute. But it put that change in subparagraph C of the final version, which again is not shown in any way as a change to existing law. Nor is the provision in subsection B through any strike through, or in the case of subsection C with bold or all cap letters in the text. And I think that's particularly confusing to a voter because there are other changes shown in all caps. And so if a voter is reading this measure, they're not going to know what has been changed, and in fact might see this and think, oh, okay, well the tax schedule isn't changed because there's nothing to denote it as having been changed through this proposal. So it leads to significant voter confusion about what was not only proposed in the original and then what is in the final version. And that's important, not only because they provide notice to you all about what the measure is doing, but it provides it to the public. And if the statutory requirement is going to have any meaning at all, and we take seriously that it has to give some sort of notice to the public so they are aware of what's going on, then I think you have to say that this measure is flawed in that regard. Let me talk about...
And specifically that's the amounts that are listed here.
Yes. Which is 1A of our motion. So turning to 1B of our motion, the amended draft, we talked about this last time. And again, I think the question before the board is, I understand the need to facilitate the citizen petition process and their ability to put parentage on the ballot. And citizens are typically not lawyers, and we don't want to hold them to an overly exacting standard of drafting. But the statute specifically requires that the amended draft show what's being changed between the original and the final version. And I think, again, at some point, a measure becomes so flawed in that process that it simply doesn't meet the standard, that it's too confusing, and that the public has lost its ability to know what changes is being made. The board has lost its ability to know what changes are being proposed. And the measure becomes unable to fulfill the statutory requirement. The statute actually says, we talked about this last time, that the changes have to be highlighted or otherwise indicated. That doesn't mean indicate where the changes are made. That means indicate what the changes are being made and what those changes are. It doesn't necessarily require bolds or caps or strike-throughs or highlights. It's simply saying, show us what you're changing, not where it's being changed, where in the measure it's being changed. And this measure simply doesn't meet that requirement or even intent of the statute. Second, the amended draft fails to indicate at least one substantive change between the original and the final. Mr. Blake pointed this out last time. And I think it's section 5 of the measure. It's the reference to the local district colleges. Those were in the original and are not in the final and are not shown as being stricken in the amended draft. And I'll talk about those again in a second as a substantive change, but just in terms of a pure drafting and the requirement of 140.105.4 to have an amended version that tracks the changes that are being made, it fails to meet that requirement. So I think when you take these changes collectively, I think you can include the sort of typographical errors, but also the substantive errors in the measure, it simply fails to meet that requirement. Okay, so then we talk about the changes that were made after review and comment and whether they're substantial or not. We had this discussion last time about when is a measure so different in its final version than its original version, regardless of whether it's responsive to comments made at review and comment, that it's simply a new measure that needs to be submitted for review and comment hearing. I think we have that here. If you think about it, the best way to do this, I think, is think about this from the perspective of a small oil and gas producer. You're a good citizen, and you do your civic duty, and you follow what's going on in the initiative process, and you're a small producer, and you see that this measure's been filed, and you think, oh, well, all right, for the rest of this year, it's going to double or triple my taxes, depending on which part of the schedule they are. But after January 1, I have no taxes. This is a great measure for me. I had zero liability after January 1, 2018 in terms of my taxes on severances. Then we get the final version, which actually does almost the opposite. It has the tax in place until the end of January 1, and then imposes those taxes at the increased amounts, or in this case, the wholesale amount, because under the original version, there was no tax after January 1, in amounts up to 10%. If you're a small oil and gas producer, that is a fundamentally different measure than was proposed in the original version. And at some point, I think that's what makes a measure different. And such that it would have to go back for review and comment to get the public notice and to give Ledge Council and Legislative Legal Services a chance to review it. We cited last time the NRA Liberty Gaming case. I think that the board can rely on that case again, and this time to find that the measure is just so substantially different that it needs to go back for another hearing. There were other changes that were made to the measure, two specifically that arguably were responsive or came up after review and comment hearing is maybe a better way to say it. Number one, the change to the clean energy provisions. We talked about last time. The question was raised in the review and comment memo. The comment was made that the reference to the Clean Energy Fund statute was an incorrect citation, that there was another statutory citation regarding the Clean Energy Fund, and the question was simply asked if the proponents want to cross-reference that statute instead. But that's not what the proponents did. The proponents then actually took that 10% allocation and moved it over to education funding. That's not responsive. It might have been in the context of saying, yes, they referenced that section of the initiative, but the question was about the statutory citation only. It was a technical comment, not a substantive, would you rather put the money in education funding? Again, it's a different measure than what was originally proposed. The second one, and I think this was Mr. Blake's point last time, was with regard to the local colleges. And frankly, I didn't make this argument last time, when thinking about it, I think it is an important point. The measure, that came up because it looks like it's a repetitive line in Section 5 referencing local, local community colleges, I think. But it's actually two different statutory citations. And the comment in the review, at the review and comment stage was, both of those references are incorrect statutory citations. Again, it was just a technical reference about the statutory citation. What the proponents did was simply strike those provisions. Now, what does that do substantively? In the original version with that language in there, part of the funding could go to, and I learned this between the last hearing and this one, those are the two-year community colleges. So there was funding provided in this original version for the two-year community colleges through the scholarship program. By striking those scholarships are no longer available. They're only available to the colleges and universities, I believe the four-year colleges and universities that meet the definition of higher institutions of higher education. So it's a fundamental change to the measure that you can't reasonably say was discussed at review and comment. Turning more broadly to, I think, the measure itself, and I won't go through these line by line, but I'm on page 6 and 7 of our motion. The measure raises a variety of questions about just fundamentally what it does and what it means. Not what the effect will be, but what actually the measure does inherently. And the legislative staff raised a variety of questions that we walked through here on pages 6 and 7. Again, I won't go through them. Trying to understand what the measure did so that it could evaluate the measure and so that you all, as part of your process, could evaluate the measure. And there were a variety of responses from the proponents, which we quote in response taken from the reporting of the review and comment, where it seems that the proponent either didn't understand what the measure does or simply vacillated between saying it does one thing and then in response to the staff said, oh yeah, it does the opposite. The one that I think is worth pointing out is the one it's our number 2 at the bottom of page 6. It's question 3C of the review and comment memo. And it asked, if voters approve the measure in November 2017 and it becomes effective after January 1, 2018, then would the change be retrospective, changing the taxes for 2017? The proponent first responded no, but then changed his answer to would. And then after legislative council responded that the measure's language indicated that it would in fact be retroactive to 2000, the proponent changed his answer to yes. So he confirmed what the legislative council had said, which is that the measure applies retroactively to 2000, meaning all the taxes that had been paid since 2000 need to be retroactively increased, and then presumably the producers would then owe those back taxes. And if that's not crystal clear, that raises, which I'll talk about in a bit, but that raises all kinds of questions regarding the title and how we drafted it. But if there's a question about whether it does that or not, or the proponent's not sure whether it does that, then I don't know how you all can understand the measure and adequately set a title. All right, let me pause there rather than turning to single subjects. I think those are some of the issues we raised last time, and I'll see if there's any questions, or I'll give Mr. O'Connor a chance to respond.
Do you have a question?
I don't have any questions on part one. I do have, mostly I'd like to hear Mr. O'Connell's response to the retrospective question.
And I have one question.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Dunn, in terms of your argument relying on the Idaho Springs case, in terms of the measure was changed by adding a provision so substantially that it needs to go back through review and comment. And looking at the case, in that situation, as I read through the facts, what happened was and it had a description of what the exchange was
during the review and comment meeting, where the proponents gave no indication at all that they meant it to be broader than just, I think, Idaho Springs, no effect to anything else. And then when they filed with Title Board, that version then affected wherever limited gaming was allowed. And so that was part of the court's rationale in saying this is a new measure, substantially changed, it needs to go back for review and comment. In this situation, in terms of the tax rates, both in paragraph B and C in the measure, and the discussion, there was a discussion in terms of the proponents indicating their intent to increase the rates for at least 2017, begging the issue about does it go back retroactively to other years, but that the proponent's intent was to change the, increase the rates for that year, and those same rate increases to continue in 2018. That's a difference in facts from the Idaho Springs case you cited. Is that correct?
I thought about that question. I don't see the NRA gaming case as a review and comment case. I don't think it was argued in that case that, hey, or the discussion in that case was not, was it responsive or not? I think the issue in that case was, is it so substantial that it constitutes a new measure? And that's a different question. That's a sort of 105.1 versus a 105.2 question.
And I agree that it's the latter question, but I think the court was relying on the fact that the purpose of the review and comment meeting is to give public notice of what's in the measure. And since there was no discussion during the review and comment meeting of broadening the provision to apply to all limited gaming in the state, not just the Idaho Springs new limited gaming, that was the reason to send it back, because once it was amended and filed with the Title Board, the public had no notice because there was no discussion in the previous review and comment meeting. Whereas in this situation, there was a discussion that the questions raised, not that it was directly responsive to the change, I understand that, but the public was put on notice by the discussion that it was the proponent's intent to increase the severance tax rates for at least 2017 and forward 2018 and subsequent years. Part of the court's rationale seemed to be the fact that there was no discussion of this new intent, this new avenue, this new approach that was taken in the version filed of the Title Board, and that's why they said to send it back. Whereas this situation seems to be different, where the proponents did indicate, so the public had some notice, because there was that discussion during the review and comment meeting, that was the proponent's intent regarding the tax rates.
Yeah. I would have to go back and read the case specifically with that question in mind. But as I said, we talked about that and said, is that case a review and comment case, or is it a just substantial change case? And I don't think it turned on whether or not there was a discussion about that issue at review and comment. I think it turned on just that it was a wholly different measure and needed to be returned. The example I was thinking about is if Mr. O'Connor had been asked at review and comment, hey, wouldn't you really rather raise this money through a tobacco tax than a severance tax? And he says, well, that's a pretty good idea. I think I will change that. And then the final version shifts it to a tobacco tax. I don't think anyone would say that didn't need to go back through review and comment. That's a wholly different measure, a tobacco tax versus a severance tax to fund these particular initiatives. And I think that's what essentially happened here, is the original version eliminated the severance tax on small producers after January 1. That is fundamentally different than doubling or tripling the tax on small producers. It's just a different measure. And yes, I think if the public happens to be listening, which other than those who are inclined to do it that are probably just lawyers and staff at the legislature, there's probably nobody in the public listening from a public standpoint. And I don't think you should create an opportunity for proponents to hide the ball. And I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it would create that opportunity where someone could say, well, you know what, I don't want to create a lot of attention on my measure, so I'll file it. It's a very narrow provision, and then I'll induce a comment at review and comment, and then I can broaden it for title board and make it a much more expansive measure and try and hide the ball and sneak it past the review and comment process by simply eliciting a comment on what my intentions are. I don't think you should condone, not that again that's happening here, but I think by just saying as long as it was discussed, that's good enough. I think you need to evaluate from a perspective of, is it just fundamentally different between the final version and the original version?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to address the question that was asked in regard to the retroactive tax, I believe. And I wanted to say that in response to that, you know, oil and gas hasn't paid its fair share in severance tax ever here in Colorado. They pay an effective severance tax of about 1.5%. Wyoming and New Mexico pay about 6.5%. Oil and gas owes these back taxes. So that's how I wanted to answer the question on retroactive. And now I just wanted to talk a little bit about if I could just address the title board in regard to a couple of other issues, if I might.
Well,
go ahead.
The back taxes. I mean, you're saying that that's what your measure does, or that's what you think should happen? I mean, you're saying it from a, you believe your measure goes back and collects.
You just made a policy argument. My question is, does the measure or does the measure not require the application of retroactive and therefore the collection retroactively of taxes?
I have to look at the language. And.
But you wrote it, right?
I did write it. What exact wording are you talking about, please?
I'm asking you. You're the proponent of the language.
Okay.
This has gone back and forth. This was put in Mr. Dunn's request for rehearing. I'm sure you've read that. I know it came up at review and comment. My question is, I actually thought quite simple, and it's for clarity's sake. Does the provision obligate the payment of taxes retroactively, or does it not? There's no wrong answer. It's just what is the language do? What's your intent?
I know. I'm just thinking about it.
Okay.
I'm trying to think about my intent. It's been a while since I wrote this. I think when I wrote it, I think my intent was that it was retroactive.
Okay.
So can I?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I wanted to first, you know, address the burden of proof here, and I think, you know, the title board knows that the burden of proving procedural noncompliance rests with the petitioner, not with the proponents of the initiative. And you know, that's petition on campaign and political finance 877 Pacific 2nd 311 Colorado 1994. That case found that because the petitioner has not shown any defect in the proceeding that would destroy the board's jurisdiction in the matter, the petitioner's jurisdiction challenge was rejected in that case. I think that case is relevant here. Also, the board has discretion to set the titles and the summary proposed initiatives despite a proponent's failure to indicate all of the differences between the original and final versions of the measure submitted to the Secretary of State. And I think that's what Mr. Dunn was talking about. That case is a matter of Prop in the Constitutional Amendment 1996-3-917 Pacific 7-2774 Colorado 1996. And I call your attention to that case because I think that is also very relevant here. Um, On April 7th, the Title Board acted properly in granting jurisdiction and setting title of ballot initiative 2017-2018 number 20. Council's motion for rehearing fails to set forth in a manner consistent with section 140-107 CRS any substantive changes. And it's well established in Colorado that's in the interest of public policy of the Title Board to confer jurisdiction on citizen ballot initiatives. Provisions relating to the initiative should be liberally construed to permit, if possible, the exercise by the electors of their most important privilege. And this is Brownlow versus Wunsch, 103 Colorado 120, 1938. I don't believe there's any substantive changes between the edited version and the final version. I don't think there's any voter confusion here. I think that the job here is to accurately reflect the ballot measure, and I think that as written, it does that. There's another case here that titles must be fair, clear, accurate, and complete, and I believe that that's what we have here, and that's in reballot title 2005-2006, number 17, that's 135 Pacific 3rd, 736, and that's a 2006 Colorado case. I'm not hiding the ball. I believe this is clear. I believe it puts the voters on notice. And I worked back and forth with staff to iron out any kind of misunderstandings or and to clarify, and I think that was done. And I think that a lot of the issues that Mr. Dunn is talking about is just an attempt to relitigate what's already been decided. And I believe the court properly granted jurisdiction. If you have any questions, I'll answer them.
Well, I mean, you said that, you know, there was this back and forth with staff, which, you know, first of all, really isn't the controlling point. It's about whether people had noticed, not, you know, how did this affect staff. And the other issue is you said that, you know, all these matters got worked out. And I guess I'm not entirely sure how you can make that argument when you're here telling us that you believe the tax is retroactive and nowhere in that question does that appear. I mean, there clearly must still be some confusion about that issue and however many more issues. And I think that's where I'm personally struggling a little bit is, what is the measure doing? And I'm not saying that proponents are always required to know exactly what their measures do. We commonly, not commonly, but occasionally set title where we don't really know the impacts in the future, but and neither do the proponents. But on something like as central to a feature as a retroactive tax, I would expect that that issue would have been vetted out, and it appears it wasn't.
Okay, I'd like to answer what I think, what I believe the ballot initiative does. I believe that it raises a severance tax of 10% on oil and gas. I believe it gets rid of the stripper well exemption as well as the ad valorem tax deduction. That's what I think this does.
And you think it does it retroactively?
You know, honestly, this is the first time that this issue's been brought to my attention today. The first time I heard it was when I read the motion for rehearing, and when I heard Mr. Dunn today. I really didn't pay that much attention to it because, you know, frankly, I hadn't thought about it, and I thought that this was settled. So
settled how, though? Settled that it was retroactive or settled that it wasn't?
I just didn't think it was an issue. I'm sorry. I didn't think it was an issue.
Well, I want to, the in your exchange during review and comment, question 3C seems to focus directly on this. If voters approve the measure and it becomes effective 2018, then would the change be retrospectively change for taxes for 2017, which is at least 1 year, which is going to be eventually a question for the fiscal analyst. But so I, it's, I guess it even goes on to talk about whether or not the tax is starting in 2000. The proponent changed his answer to yes.
Okay, I just...
So so this has been an issue in the past. I'm just trying to clarify for the record.
My co-sponsor just clarified something.
Okay.
She just told me, and I think she's right. My wife is always right.
mine too.
Okay. During the discussion, she reminded me that we had agreed that it applied to 2017, but it wasn't retroactive. She just corrected me. Okay, because now I'm starting to remember the...
This is the first time I've heard 2000. When we were in the review and comment, what the comment was, is this retroactive for 2017? And we said, yes, we believe it is. I don't recall them saying anything to 2000, all the way back to 2000. I want to address something. I don't know if this is the time. The bracket in the middle of the measure, when at the beginning of the measure, when it talks about the 10%.
I'm sorry. Before you go into
okay,
it,
sorry.
I mean, there's a number of issues here. I want to make sure the record's clear on them all. Can I just ask Mr. Dunn? Mr. Dunn, in your petition for rehearing, you discussed this on page 7 at the top. You go, what you're describing is the back and forth, if I understand correctly, between proponents and ledge counsel. And it looks as though you represent here that ledge counsel did ask proponents about taxes starting in 2000. And that I presume that comes off of the recording or the transcript. It's not expressly in 3C.
Give me one second.
Yeah, I think the discussion at review and comment asked about retroactivity, and the question says, right, will it apply for tax years that begin prior to January 1? So they're referring to not just 17, but to tax years prior to that. I'll also note that in the fiscal impact statement on page 2, the third paragraph, it says the measure changes the statute so that the tax rate increase applies to tax years 2000 through 2017. Now, the next sentence goes on to say they only applied it to 2017, which I think is odd, but we talk about that in the abstract context or the title context. But I think ledge counsel, who obviously participated in the review and comment hearing and then did the fiscal impact statement, specifically says that the measure applies retroactively to tax years back to 2000.
Right. That was, eventually, we're going to get there to the fiscal analyst. So you do. What? So I'm sorry.
What?
Well, we can do it right now if you'd like.
That'd be great.
So all right. Can you pass the microphone to the fiscal analyst? So maybe you can clarify for this for us. In the original provision, it talks about 2000. There's this back and forth during review and comment between the proponents and ledge counsel about retroactive taxes. Your fiscal note touches upon it. What say you about this issue of retroactive taxes?
Sure. So for the record, I'm Larson Silva. I'm an economist with Colorado Legislative Council staff. I helped conduct the review and comment hearing along with an attorney from Legislative Legal Services, and then I also worked on the fiscal impact statement. So when we were preparing the review and comment memo, the question was asked whether it was retroactive to 2017, and only that single year, based on sort of the legal interpretation that going back any farther couldn't possibly be done without being explicit that it was a retroactive tax.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the review and comments question was drafted, is, you know, just for 2017. You know, we asked the questions, and the response is, I think, accurately portrayed in the brief, where there was some confusion about whether it was retroactive and how that applied and where in the measure we were reading to prepare the review and comment hearing that it was retroactive to 2017. And then we brought up that the measure says it goes back to 2000. So that's my recollection of it. I can talk about the fiscal or the abstract and the fiscal impact statement now as well, or.
Well, maybe I should ask. So again, just help me so I make sure I understand and so the record is clear. The fiscal analysis does not include any back taxes from 2000 to 2016.
That's correct.
Is that just because it was determined by you all that that would be unlawful because it's not expressed in the provision?
Essentially, I mean, that was the advice we got from the legislative attorneys that, you know, helped us sort of understand the measure and ask the questions. And so we do apply the first year of impact, the 1.2 million or the 138 million is sort of the impact of on 2017 taxes subject to the higher tax rates.
Okay. I don't know if anyone else has questions, but.
No. Sure.
I think what I heard there was that Legislative Council understood the measure to apply retroactively, but then on advice from Legislative Legal Services, because there might be a question about the constitutionality of applying it retroactively, only conducted the calculation for 2017 and beyond and after. Now, I think that's what I heard, and they can correct me if I misunderstood the comment. But believing that the measure would be unconstitutional, of course, should not be a valid consideration in the review and comment in the title board process. The job of the title board, as you guys have said many times, is to not evaluate the constitutionality of it, but to just simply evaluate what the measure says. And I would contend that Ledge Council should do the same thing. And what I just heard was Legislative Council saying it does apply retroactively to 2000, but because it may not be legal, we only applied it in 2017 and after. And just to foreshadow the argument for the abstract and the title, if that's the case, then the number in the title is off by many orders of magnitude.
I'd let him go first if I were you. Mr. O'Connell.
I just wanted to clarify that part of the reason why we wrote the initial fiscal impact with the 2017 retroactivity is that the purpose of the abstract or the impact statement is to be as accurate as possible. And so if the measure passed and the revenue started coming in, we wanted to estimate what we thought was reasonable to expect if it did pass rather than trying to estimate the back taxes.
Mr. O'Connell?
Thank you. I think I'm hearing really a constitutional argument here, and I just wanted to cite a case here. It says, but a proposed ordinance is clothed with the presumption of validity, and its constitutionality will not be considered by the courts by means of a hypothetical question, but only after enactment. City of Rockford versus Brown, 133, Colorado 262, 1956. And I think that Mr. Dunn is making a constitutional argument here, and that's what I felt like when I read his brief. And this is not the time or place to challenge constitutionality or validity of this proposed initiative.
I don't think he's making a constitutional argument. I think what he's saying is that the way you wrote this initiative, it could apply back taxes back to 2000, but this question says nothing about that, and that would be a huge central issue to your initiative. And so we can't just disregard it.
Could I respond to that?
Sure.
So again, 2000, like my wife said, this is the first time we've heard that year. And that is not what I understood. My understanding again was when we had the exchange, it was going back a year, not to 2000. That was what I understood it to be.
So one question for you and then one comment to my colleague. Question. 2,000 is in the original provision. I mean, that's what you wrote. It can't be that that's the first time you've heard, considered, or faced this.
Now, I'm not sure he wrote it, or if...
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's just a comma, and then he wrote
2,000 in the original? I mean, that's...
Yeah, Sharon. I'm not sure he put it... I think it might have existed, and then he added to it, and so it just...
And part of this, I mean, I'm speaking from a drafting perspective. In terms of amending existing law, which is the 3929-105-1B, right now, 1B sets forth the tax rates. Current law is for taxable years commencing on and after January 1, 2000. That's the current law.
Right.
And the rates are lower rates. I think they start 2% at their graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So from a drafting perspective, normally if the intent is to make it applicable, a tax rate increase applicable beginning in 2017, then you would window off what is now the current rate for 2000, but prior to January 1st, 2017. And then you would have a rate for 2017 and then 2018 which is in the C that the proponents included in their measure. The fact that this was drafted just to say, but so it's commencing on and after January 1st, 2000, but prior to January 1st, 2018, doesn't close off the existing rates for those prior years. So starting with 2000, the way it's drafted, arguably, it changes the rates for all of those tax years, 2000, but prior to 2018.
Right.
Right.
Okay. I'm hopefully helping explain that to the proponents in terms of where this argument is coming from.
And I guess I have a couple of, one, it seems to me that this was raised during notice and comment. Maybe there was an understanding that was reached. That understanding doesn't reveal itself in the language or in a change in the amended version. That I see. And secondly, I don't think I understood Mr. Dunn's argument to kind of be twofold. Here, it can only be going to whether or not it creates voter confusion, I think, though it may also be a constitutional question, which I agree with Mr. O'Connor, is not to be decided here.
Okay. In terms of the issue about the discussion at review and comment, and looking at the review and comment memo that I've got, and I think the other title board, the question was only in terms of 2017. And I did go back using the citation that Mr. Dunn gave us in terms of the audio. I did go back and listen to that discussion. And my understanding of that discussion is that it was only trying to ascertain the proponent's intent in terms of the retroactive nature to 2017, so that the discussion mirrored the questions posed, and there was no discussion about the years prior to 2017, despite the way the language appears in the four corners of the final version of the measure before us. That discussion didn't happen during review and comment, at least from the audio that I heard, in terms of retrospective all the way back to 2000.
So then in Mr. Dunn's motion, the discussion about the taxes started in 2000, you didn't hear that on the...
I did not hear that part in that portion of the audio.
There's a microphone down there, too. I mean, if you want to just...
So my recollection is that, and I could be wrong, my question is that I agree on the review and comment memo, but then I think there was a question from review and from the staff that said, I guess just parroting the memo itself, and then I think there was a discussion. I thought the year 2000 was referenced. Now, whether his answer was retroactive or whether the general, there was some confusion about whether they're talking about 2017 or prior to that, but or maybe it was just in quoting the language in the in the measure. But as I recall it, there was a discussion of, or at least a reference in by Ledge Council about whether it was retroactive to 2000. But I'd have to go back and listen to it again.
And it could be just our recollections are different. But I only heard the discussion in regard to being retrospective on 2017. But it's session. I'm tired. But that was my understanding
right.
And recollection.
Right. And I think we may be getting a little off track here because I think, well, first of all, let me start back with what Mr. O'Connor led his comments with here. His opening comment was, the oil and gas industry has not paid its fair share and since 2000, and they should be required to pay that. So his initial response was, yes, they ought to pay that. And he said, that was my intent of the measure. It was only after his co-proponent told him otherwise that he's changed it. So I think his view of what it does has gone back and forth, depending on whether he's concerned about making sure the industry pays what he views as fair share of taxes versus what's happening here on the process side. So I think the proponents would like it to apply retroactively back to 2000. But I think more importantly, look at what the language says. I mean, the language is, as I think Ms. Eubanks just said, it says it applies back to 2000. Now again, Mr. O'Connor is exactly right. Whether that's constitutional or not is not an issue here today. The question is, what does the language say? And the language clearly says that for taxes, tax rates after 2000, that these new tax rates, which aren't shown in the measure, but are increased, will apply. It's up to the state then to figure out whether that's constitutional and whether they can apply it. I understand Ledge Council's point that they wanted to come up with a number that they thought would actually come in for constitutional reasons or otherwise, but I would argue that's not what the measure says, and that the evaluation in the title and in the fiscal impact statement should show what the measure says it does.
Maybe I'll keep it.
Mr. O'Connor, do you have any? I know you were talking to your daughter there, so I.
Do either of the proponents have a comment about that, or we can move to the next more? Discuss further.
I would say that our intention was 2017 retroactive, and I would say that from looking at the way it is written, I mean, I guess from a voter's perspective, I would say that it is pretty clear that it's 2017. I would just say that our intention was never for it to go back to 2000, and that's what when it was brought up in the review and comment section, that's what we said. Yes, 2017 was our intention.
I think the other point I'd make, and this is jumping ahead to sort of the vagueness argument, right? The very fact that we're having this discussion, the very fact that Ledge Council was unsure, the very fact that the proponents have vacillated between, yes, it's retroactive to 2000, no, it's only to 2017, and the lack of understanding that we've had trying to decipher what it means, all shows that how can you write a title when it doesn't even seem to be anybody in the room who actually has a definitive opinion on what it says. And it is easy to envision that there would be litigation out of this measure, right? If it is deemed to only apply to 2017, does anybody doubt that somebody would sue and say the language clearly says it applies back to 2000 and that the taxes should be applied retroactively? And I would argue that the title board's job in this situation is to send it back and say, look, just rewrite it. Send it back to review and comment. Clarify whatever it is you want to do, and then we'll go from there.
I would disagree. I would say we never had a conversation about 2000. And I will say that it's not on the record. You will not find it on the record because it wasn't there. We had a conversation. The direct question was about 2017, and that was the answer that we gave.
Well, I mean, whether it's on the record or not, I suppose. I mean, you would agree that in its final form, the chart that you added in references back to on page one at the bottom, paid for each taxable year commencing on or after January 1, 2000, but prior to January 1, 2018. I mean, that's what it reads, right? So I guess the issue is was anyone on notice I mean, I suppose you could say that from the language they were, but there's an awful lot of confusion about whether anyone would be on notice. And I think to Mr. Dunn's point, if this were to pass and the language looks like this, that's a lot of money. I can't imagine it wouldn't end up in litigation. I mean, that's not talking about 1 year of taxes or, I mean, that's a large increase going back to 2000. I guess my next question, though, had to do with Mr. Dunn's argument that a person reading the original also might not know that a tax was going to continue in 2018. They may have just read it to end at 2017. Do you want to address that? Yeah.
I guess my so the way that it is originally written, that chart was intended to be in there, but it was not, and it was highlighted when it was added, and the discussion came up at review and comment probably because it clearly from the language leading up to it, there was a belief that it was intended to be in there, and I think that was part of the discussion at review and comment was that, oh, we just really hadn't when we wrote it. So I think that from the language, you could tell that it was intended to be in there. So I think somebody looking at the original and then looking at the second wouldn't say, oh, I thought that was such a substantive change.
So you don't think somebody could have looked at it and said, I'm not going to bother to go because as of 2018, there's no tax?
No.
Well, and again, I know, having listened to the audio, as referenced in Mr. Dunn's motion for rehearing, there was a discussion about the fact, and understanding that the proponents, as Mr. O'Connor said, if he used the 2008 initiated measure as a basis, took a totally different approach than what this measure is attempting to do. Because first of all, so this 2008, it didn't change the existing rates. It only changed it prospectively starting in 2009 and exempted lower producing wells and had the 300,000 and over income level for taxation and eliminated the business personal property tax exemption. So it was a totally different approach. So in terms of taking that and making it into something else, the language in the original, in terms of just the paragraph C, only including the 300,000 and over, was based, I believe, and based on the comments that were made during review and comment, on the 2008 initiative, because that's the way it was drafted, and the questions were raised, and it was discussed in terms of the proponents. And I'm just saying, my listening to the audio, my understanding of the discussion was of having the rate increases for at least 2017, that was the discussion, and then continuing those rate increases in 2018 and forward. And so in terms of this confusion of taking one measure and trying to make it into something else,
research and see if there's something from 2008. They're just looking at your initiative on its face to determine, does this impact me? Should I be tracking this? The whole purpose of the notice and everything else. And then you got to Ledge Council, and they were, you know, pretty sophisticated about getting to where they believed you were going. But I don't know if that satisfies statutorily the changes that you made, whether they are so different in the initiative versus what you originally presented. I'm not necessarily focused on the, I think you made those changes in response to review and comment, but I'm not sure that you were permitted to make it so substantially different than what you submitted at review and comment. And I guess that's what I would like to hear from you. Whether you think that what you submitted at review and comment is so different than what you came up with, without sort of the, I knew where I was going and so did they. What about the average person?
I mean, to me, Madam Chairman, it seems clear to me. I do think that the average person would be on notice. I think it's clear, and I did respond to the suggestions made at the comment and hearing, and that's what I did.
Any questions?
I only have a question for you all.
I have a question for Mr. Connor in terms of what he said in response to a different argument. So
sure.
If we're done with this particular aspect, if that would be possible. Mr. O'Connor, and this goes back to whether or not you've complied with the statutory requirement of filing the original and amended version and the final version in compliance with 140.105 sub 4. In response, you cited a case, a 1996 case, I believe, that said that, I think you went through it very quickly, and so I'd like to know more about this case and whether you have a copy of the case that sort of substantial compliance or not showing all the changes was held to be okay. And I'm paraphrasing very badly, but.
Yes, I have it right here.
And the case is?
It is matter of Prop Initiative Constitutional Amendment 1996-3. 917 Pacific 7, 1274, Colorado, 1996. And again, the case holds that title board had discretion to set the titles and summary of proposed initiative despite proponents' failure to indicate all of the differences between the original and final versions of the measure submitted to the Secretary of State.
Okay, and fortunately, I was just provided a copy of that case. I found a different case, which is a 1998 case, Phillips versus Buckley, which, although it set forth what the proponents did in terms of they filed the original version, an amended version, a second amended version, and then the final version, which there were variations between those all, that substantial compliance was rejected by the Supreme Court. And so I'd like, since I have the two cases, if there's other questions you want to, or things you want to talk about while I look at this case and try to distinguish them, I'd like to just for a moment. Thank you.
My other question's actually of her, so that doesn't help. But I don't know if Mr. Dunn has any more that he wants to expand on for his rehearing, or whether or not there's anything else Mr. O'Connor wants to?
Oh, I'm just getting warmed up.
Well, we're staying on jurisdiction, so don't.
No, on that point, I do want us to make sure, though, that we don't lose sight of the arguments that I started with, which are simply that the original version of the measure doesn't show what's being changed in current law. And I think that's a fundamental question. I don't know of any measure that's ever come out of the title board or been on the ballot that actually had new language replacing existing law
It doesn't show what that change is. I have never seen that come out of the title board, and I think that's a fundamental question here is, this does not show that those rates are changed, among other provisions, but it doesn't fundamentally show that those rates are changed in the original submitted version. And so I don't want us to lose track of that as sort of the initial issue. That's the first one we raise in our motion.
I just had a question. Is it possible for my wife to take my daughter to the bathroom?
Sure.
Sure.
You bet. We'll just wait. She's reading these cases anyway, so we can wait a minute.
There were, it's a bit of an anomaly in the number of different versions that were provided throughout the process. And at least
my- And marked differently,
right.
Yes.
And then my quick read of it was the court's looking at a lot more and a lot more changes that are a lot more substantive. That was the distinguishing factor for me is that case was vastly more complex factually than the fact pattern we have here, which seems to be more in line with the 96 case. But they don't, obviously the 96 doesn't cite the 98, but the 98 doesn't cite this one. Neither one of them is, they're both good case law as far as I know, counsel.
The 98 one's without.
Right.
They reject the arguments and affirm the action of the title board without opinion. How compelling that is.
Right.
It's not so.
If I may, and I assume we're still on the record.
Yeah.
If the question is whether the measure substantially complies with the requirements of 105.4, I think there are cases where that would be a tough call, where there was a minor edit here, a typo there, even a maybe more substantial single mistake. I don't think you have to decide here whether that doctrine applies, because the number of errors between the original and the final are so numerous that I don't see how we can say it substantially complies. It doesn't show the changes directly. It provides highlighting of section headings where there happen to be changes in the section. It shows it wholesale with regard to the two I talked about earlier, the reference to the colleges. I forget the other issue.
Environment.
Oh, environment, thank you. And it doesn't show those whatsoever. On top of that, there are the numerous typographical errors. So I think if we're talking about whether there was substantial compliance, again, it's back to what I led with in terms of what 105.4 requires. It's not just a simply showing where the changes were made in the document. It's actually what the changes are. That's the important point, is to show, okay, how did you change it from the original to the final? And I think, you know, we pointed out in the motion, the discussion last time, I really put a fine point on it. I think there was a very difficult discussion about how to describe the tax rate increase in the measure. And I think that stemmed from the fact that in reading the original and the amended and the final, you couldn't tell what was happening. And that's because the amended didn't track those changes. And so it wasn't until Ms. Eubanks actually, I think, pulled out the fiscal impact statement to figure out what the rates were previously so that we could, or you could, describe what changes were being made. And that's the whole point of the amended draft, is just so you can see clearly in one place. As I mentioned last time, we actually had to run in a red line ourselves just to figure out what was going on between the two drafts. And I would say that we can't expect the general public to have to do that to figure out what's going on.
Madam Chairman, I wanted to point the title board in the direction of a case. And the case says that even if reasonable minds may differ as to the sufficiency of a title, the title should be held to be sufficient. And that's Say versus Baker, 137 Colorado 155, 1958. And it's another case. And I think this goes to Mr. Dunn's argument, is it's not the court's function to write the best possible titles. And, you know, that's ballot title 1999-2000, number 256, 12 Pacific 3rd, 246, Colorado 2000. And I just don't think that the statute demands perfection. This is a citizen's initiative. And I think that we do the best we can with what we got. And again, I think that there aren't any substantive changes in this, and I think it gives the voters reasonable notice, and I believe it's clear.
So, Ms. Eubanks, I guess I just have a question for you, which is, so regardless of the outcome of the retrospective question, that is, how far back it goes, I do think it would have to be something that we were to put in the title. And since it's a jurisdictional question, I'm going to ask the question now. How would you describe it as 2000 or 2017? The measure says 2000. The fiscal note only does 2017. The number that's used in it, the only number we have to use, excludes 2000 to 2016, if that's the proper interpretation. How would you describe the retrospective? And the reason I'm asking the question is not so much because I need an answer, it's because I don't think we could write a title without it being misleading, without knowing the answer to that. Having an answer to that requires us to look at the legal, constitutional. We're not allowed to do that. So I'm struggling with how to get, and I understand it's a little security, I'm getting there a little roundabout, but.
Okay. My take on it is, and I think it's been the normal practice of the title board in drafting titles, that we go based on the language of the measure, from the four corners of the measure. I mean, although it's been put into the record a lot of the discussion about what happened, you know, at review and comment meeting and all of those sorts of things, and people have difference of opinions as to what language means, we tend not to take that into consideration and we go with the language of the measure before us. I would read the measure before us to be retrospective to 2000, the way it's drafted. So I think, and this is just my opinion, I think the title is incorrect in terms of how it explains the measure. Because right now, the title that we set just talked about the existing severance tax rates, which is true, but I think now we would have to work in the retrospective nature. I mean, whether it's by year reference or somehow, I have no earthly idea in terms of the amount that was provided by legislative council to comply with Tabor, because that does not include, and I don't know which is the first full fiscal year. I don't know. Whether that is that 2000, is that 2017? I don't quite know in terms of where we end up on that. But in terms of, based on the language of the measure, just looking at it cold, I think it's retrospective until going back to 2000, and that we would need to amend the title to reflect that fact. Otherwise, it is misleading.
Well, I mean, again, so maybe that's a bit of a procedural question. I agree with you. I read it that way too. I'm happy to. The only reason that we went down kind of the rabbit hole of review and comment was because I wanted to make sure that the proponent had engaged on it, and I'm satisfied that there was an engagement. Now, there may not have been a meeting of the minds, but I'm comfortable that these issues were discussed. I agree with you that it makes it retrospective, just the plain reading of it. But we don't have a fiscal note that reflects that. And I think we do need one. and the abstract certainly doesn't reflect that, and we would need that as well. So I don't know how we solve that problem.
Well, maybe we should be asking our council.
Well, first we've got to get through jurisdiction.
Well, in some ways, I think it goes to jurisdiction, but because.
Well, the exact amount doesn't.
Well, okay, fair enough.
And whether you're asking in terms of.
The confusion created does.
Well, I mean.
Whether it's misleading.
The measure is drafted the way it's drafted. Is it confusing? Mr. Dunn thinks so. I mean, you have to make, as I argued at the previous meeting, you have to sort of look at the existing law to figure out what it changes, because it doesn't conform to the normal drafting style that at least bills and most initiatives take. Is that a jurisdictional issue because it's not drafted to make those changes as apparent as if it were drafted as a bill? And not that all bills are perfect either, what you were asking me, it seems more of a timing issue in terms of if we try, I mean, in terms of our deadline of acting today.
Right.
You know, do we comply with the statutory requirement? Do we comply with the Tabor requirement? Do we comply with the other statutory requirements of having a title that it clearly explains the measure that isn't misleading?
Well, it's at least misleading as to the proponent's intent, right? They've clearly, at this point, it's clear that they meant to cover 2017, not 20,000, not 2000 to 2018. That was their intent. It's drafted differently.
Well, we've had that issue
I know.
A number of times, and we repeat the language and say, well, the voters can figure it out. I mean, you know, we just adopt, shall taxes be increased, and then just parrot the language. And
I understand. But we don't have any information that Ms. Eubanks and I may read it that way, and that may be where we would go, and maybe that's a question for the next round if we find jurisdiction. I don't.
Well, we still have an amount that works for the annual change upcoming.
Well, but is that the amount that it should be?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, but is what you collect in arrears really?
But the jurisdictional question is whether or not the measure is so confusing or misleading as to whether or not we can set a title.
Correct.
And I'm getting to the point of. I'm confused enough that I'm not sure that we can. Now, I just, as last night was no surprise, I have a different jurisdictional motion that I will make at the right point, but I want the record to be clear, which is why we're down here in retrospection land. So I don't have any more to ask about the retrospective. I'm gonna make my motion on jurisdiction on other grounds, but I am at least confused enough just on the retrospective part of it to wonder whether or not it's possible for us to set a title. But I don't have to go there in my own mind to make my motion.
I had a possibly helpful case if I could just cite.
Sure.
It.
No, you should definitely make your record, sir.
Technical correction of a proposed initiative is permitted. Allowing a technical correction of the proposed initiative to conform with the intent of the proponents does not frustrate the purpose of the statute. Speltz versus Clausing, 649, Pacific 2nd, 303, Colorado, 1982.
And it'd be your position that fixing the retrospective is technical?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think I'm comfortable with that. I know that we've done technical changes in the past. I don't think that there's anything that at least I can recall doing to that extent in terms of changing the text of a measure the way it would need to be drafted. I
don't think it's technical. I mean,
yeah.
You're sweeping arguably 16 years of severance taxes in at a rate that's different, where the people engaged in that business weren't on notice for it. I mean, anything dealing with retrospective application of people's rights is anything but technical in my mind.
Yeah. Well, do you want to have further discussion or you want to make your motion?
I'm happy to make my motion. Whether or not there are others, I don't know. Let me make the record and then I'll make the motion. So I think we lack jurisdiction to set a title, and I'm relying on three different parts. Mr. Dunn's motion lays them out, so for the record and in order of how compelling the arguments are to me, 1B, 1D, and 1A are the things that I find to be compelling. As to 1B, which is whether or not there was compliance with 140.105.4, the standard is substantial compliance. I went back and looked at this and frankly struggled with it a little bit. I think using the word highlight is unfortunate, because I think when you see highlight, you almost default to highlighter, which is, I think, what the proponent did. But I think the actual definition of highlight is something different. It is to flag it, to mark it, to make it distinct, to set it off, emphasize it, stress it, underline it, pick it out, make it different from that which it's next to. So the literal reading of highlight is there, but in reading the statute, I think I have to read it as making it different or offsetting it in a way that's clear. I think that has to be the reason for the amended version to be. And I think there is a lack of substantial compliance in the way that it was highlighted or otherwise marked. As to D, I think that the change, particularly the addition of environment, is a substantive change. I think public health is different than the environment. And if you meant environment, then that should have been in the first part. And that's particularly important to me because that phrase is used elsewhere in the statute, or elsewhere in the proposal and in the statute. So its exclusion would have been significant under a statutory construction argument. And then as to 1A, kind of what I'll just call the inconsistency argument, I'm less compelled by that, but I certainly don't think it's a frivolous argument. So I would make a motion that the board lacks jurisdiction to set a title because the proponents have not substantially complied with 140.105 subparagraph 4.
All right. I'll second it. You didn't talk about C?
I didn't find C to be compelling.
I mean, I thought a section of C, to the extent that somebody looking at the initiative wouldn't know that it was going to affect them because the chart wasn't in there and would indicate that after 2018 they would be subject to no tax, they would have to anticipate that this was going to be similar to the prior measure and that such changes would be made at review and comment. And I'm not sure that that really satisfies the notice requirement. And for the other reasons that you had mentioned, in addition to however this whole discussion fits in about retroactivity, I think that that's been very confusing. And I would similarly find that we don't have jurisdiction.
Can I just add to my comment just real quick, just to clarify? I do think the typos and things, like the environment that was added is spelled incorrectly. I do think that's the type of thing that would not trigger fixing that would not be a problem. Fixing those kinds of things, making those kinds of changes, that's the distinction I'm trying to draw. I don't find those to be compelling arguments, typos, things like that. But I do think the striking, the inconsistency, the addition of the environment, plus the highlighting, which I made a significant record on, tells me we lack jurisdiction. Thank you.
And although we have a pending motion, I'll just respond before we take our vote. Having gone back and looked at the differences between the original version and the final version and the changes that were marked and those that were not marked, I agree with Mr. Blake that in terms of the corrections of the typographical errors, even the changes to format on the amending clauses, to me, that would constitute, if those were the only things missed, that would be substantial compliance. But when you do get to amounts in terms of the split of the revenue, in terms of the removal of language as to what types of institutions the scholarships would be utilized at, and then in terms of the name of the department itself, I think I've changed my mind from my original position, and that there isn't substantial compliance in terms of the 140-105 requirements.
All right, then we have a motion and a second. Is everyone ready to vote? All those in favor?
Aye.
All right, the board has unanimously found that we don't have jurisdiction, and so I think we need to make a motion on the rehearing.
Well, since we haven't made decisions on a lot of the other grounds on the motion for rehearing, the motion would be to grant Mr. Dunn's motion for rehearing in regard to the arguments regarding substantial compliance with 140-105 sub 4, that we grant the motion on those grounds.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The motion for rehearing is granted, and so we do not have jurisdiction to continue to set title. And that concludes our hearing today. The time is 4:30, and we are adjourned.